What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. Take KUT.
90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Good evening and welcome to the July 22nd edition of Drama Text. Tonight on the show we have an hour of lecture of poems by Gary Snyder, who was presented at the University of California Lunchtime Poetry Series. So it's last the full hour, so let's start right away. Here is Gary Snyder.
Bob Hass gives me the best introductions of anybody in the world. This is, I think, maybe the second or the third time that I've had the pleasure and the honor to be introduced by Bob, and I always learn something about myself that is a little more than I want to know. I mean, it's hard to live up to. And it's a pleasure to be here again at the Doe Library, where I used to go in and out the doors as a graduate student in 1952-53, and then came back again and taught a year, 1964-65, for the English department here, while Tom Gunn took a break. And then I made my way back to Asia again, and actually I came back 40 years ago from Asia, and built a place, started a farmstead up in the forests of northern Nevada County, surrounded more or less by Bureau of Land Management land, public land, and raised two families since 1970. I get into the Bay Area and into Berkeley only occasionally, and I am no longer, regardless of what it says on the handout here, I'm no longer teaching at UC Davis. I decided I'd better leave there while I was still ahead, and retired in 1971 so that I could, not, no, 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 what year, 2001. No, I retired in 1956. I retired because, you know, the truth is, when you're teaching full-time in a university, no matter what they say, you don't have time to get any writing done. Except maybe Bob Hass does. So I decided I had a lot of projects semi-launched that I ought to give some attention to. And also my family, and also my forests, and my wildlife. What I want to do in this brief time today, it is brief, but then everything is read a few older poems that seem still relevant and touch on some things that we all know about, and then read some selections from my latest volume of poems called Danger on Peaks, which some of you would know and maybe some of you wouldn't, and then finish up by reading two or three very recent poems that haven't been well, one was published, but they're not in any books yet. That's the plan, and I'm going to try to make it fit in a neat way. I'll close out the reading, if I'm doing it right, at 10 to 1 and let you go to your classes, but I also will hang out a little longer for those who don't have to go to a class and take some questions for a little while, since I don't get down here very often and somebody might want to harass me, which I'm always open to. Oil. 1957-58. I spent 9 months working in the engine room of a American-owned bottom tanker under contract to the U.S. Navy. delivering crude oil from the Persian Gulf to various naval oil depots and ports, mostly in the Pacific, in the Eastern Pacific, a lot of them. I got my seaman's papers in the summer of 1948 when I was 18, hitchhiking to New York and connecting with some friends in New York who had connections with the National Maritime Union and the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union. And it was ultimately the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union that backed me up for the seaman's papers. And then I got a National Maritime Union union card, which I still have, although the United States, as you probably know, no longer does have a merchant marine, in fact. You can't afford it. So working on a tanker, a T2 tanker, which is a turbo-electric drive, and none of the T2 tankers are running anymore. They've all been scrapped. They build the ships much larger now. It didn't take a rocket scientist in 1956 to take note of the fact that all of the industrial nations are totally involved in projects that require fossil fuel. I don't know why they didn't notice it earlier. So this point touches on that. Oil. Soft rain squalls on the swells south of the Bonin Islands late at night. Light from the empty mess hall throws back bulky shadows of winch and fairlead over the slanting fantail where I stand. But for men on watch in the engine room, the man at the wheel, the lookout in the bow, the crew sleeps in cots on deck or narrow iron bunks down drumming passageways below. The ship burns with a furnace heart, steam veins and copper nerves, quivers and slightly twists and always goes, easy roll of the hull and steep and deep vibration of the turbines underfoot. Bearing what all these crazed, hooked nations need, steel plate, and long injections of pure oil. Steel plate. This is something that people wouldn't necessarily know. On bulk cargo carriers like tankers that have that low central deck, two decks, the deck cargo is usually rolled out plate steel. It's a good place to put it, and so they're transporting not only oil, but a little bit of steel plate from place to place, which is, you know, goes into other iron works and iron foundries to make things like automobiles and tanks and whatever else you might want. Connections with Japan and East Asia, even at that time, that was a good place to get some steel plate on your deck. I also thought of, but never managed to work it out so you would get it from the poem, that the steel plate was like the wafer and the oil was like the wine of our civilization. I had taken a break from my studies in Japan to re-energize my National Maritime Union card and my seaman's papers so that I could go out to sea and make a little money, travel all over the Pacific, Midway. I saw the nesting albatross on Midway Island. You don't get to go to Midway unless you're somehow connected, you know, with a contract for the Navy oil. And there were some Hawaiian construction workers doing some work there. But, you know, nobody was paying any attention to me, so I managed to get off the ship when I didn't have to work and went out for a long walk on the beach right through where the albatross nest, which I should not have been allowed to do. But I didn't know that. And I'm saying this right now and addressing it in a way to Bob Hass, because he was telling me just a few minutes ago about the The albatross nesting and feeding habits from, there's one species that I guess raises all of their babies on Midway Island, which is just a bunch of sandbars, actually. And then when the young need food, both the male and the female take turns flying from Midway to the Farallones to get some squid, fly back, and regurgitate it. How many miles is that? Round trip? 7,000 miles round trip. So I was really pleased to just finally learn that little extra bit there. Back in my little house in Kyoto, Japan, next to the monastery, I went back to work in my spare time reading, which was biological and ecological science, as much as I could get a hold of. And you could get a lot. They have very good bookstores in Japan with English, French, and German, as well as Japanese, of course. So I summed up my ecological understanding with this poem called Song of the Taste, ecology really being, in a sense, about how energy gets passed along from one set of beings to another set of beings, horizontally or vertically. This is about what human beings live off of, Song of the Taste. Eating the living germs of grasses, rice, wheat. Eating the ova of big birds. The fleshy sweetness packed around the sperm of swaying trees. Eating the muscles of the flanks and thighs of soft-voiced cows. The bounce in the lamb's leap. The swish in the ox's tail, eating roots grown swole inside the soil, drawing on life of living, clustered points of light spun out of space, hidden in a grape, eating each other's seed, eating, each other, kissing the lover in the mouth of bread, lip to lip. For the Children. This poem was written in the 70s in response to Dennis and Donella Meadows' book called The Limits to Growth and to the projections of population, oil availability, resource availability, food availability, and so forth at that time, which, you know, turn out to be more or less still the same case. These few years later. For the Children. The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us. The steep climb of everything going up, up as we all go down. In the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, there are valleys, pastures. We can meet there in peace, if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children, stay together. Learn the flowers. Go light. Okay. That's from a gathering of selected poems from my earlier books called No Nature. Some nature-loving radio interviewer in New York, when this book was first out, asked me, well, why did you give it that scary name, No Nature? Well, I said, well, first to head off thoughtless and excessive nature piety. And then I said, in addition, there are really two meanings to the word nature in English. One people, you know, commonly use to mean the outdoors or something like that. And the other means character, inherent qualities. And it was Hakuin who said, no nature is true nature. So I always have loved what Hakuin had to say about that. Danger on Peaks, Mount St. Helens was the reference there. St. Helens was the first mountain I ever did a mountaineering climb on when I was 15. I was a natural animist even then. And so I took advantage of the situation to pray to the mountain, which I assumed was a goddess, and ask for some kind of help of whatever sort I might need. And then the next morning, down by Spirit Lake, the Forest Service had newspapers pinned up on the wall of their bulletin board. And there were the Portland, Oregonian, 2 or 3 days late because it takes a while to drive there, big article on dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And photographs from the air and, you know, comments on it. And I was sort of horrified. So I swore my little vow that by the beautiful form of Mount St. Helens, I would resist the use and spread of nuclear weapons for my life. And the irony is that Mount St. Helens blew up in 1980, lost 2,000 feet off the top. So that I finally got back up there to spend some time with it, and that kind of generated some of the thoughts in this book called Danger on Peaks. I'll read a few of these poems. This one's called Enjoy the Day, at the end of Section 1, Mount St. Helens. One morning on a ridge top east of Lutwit, Mount St. Helens, after, I can't read very well down there, after camp stove coffee, looking at that youthful old volcano, breathing steam and sulfur, sunrise lava, bowls of snow, went up behind a mountain hemlock, asked my old advisors where they lay, what's going on? They say, new friends and dear sweet old tree ghosts, here we are again. Enjoy the day. Mariano Vallejo's library, Vallejo's library, the last Mexican governor of California. Vallejo, California, named after him. He wanted that to become the capital of California. He said, there's a good deep water port there, and it's much warmer and not nearly so foggy as San Francisco. He was right, of course. He really cast his energy with the Yankees, and he was a kind of a Enlightenment person who had gotten lots of books via British and Spanish ships, that sailing ships that came every 4 or 5 months. A ship would come into San Francisco Bay or into Monterey Bay. And he built up quite a library, and he was reading Rousseau, Voltaire. He had all of these books. In fact, it is said that he had the best library in the whole Pacific. That is to say, the best Occidental language library in the whole Pacific. On the western side of the Pacific, of course, the Chinese and Japanese had enormous libraries. People might not be aware of what is said about the Chinese books and publishing, which was that there were more books in print in Chinese as late as the year 1800 than all the other languages of the world combined. So Vallejo did have this wonderful library, which he moved eventually to his new house in Napa. A remnant of that is still there, but his original house, what they called the Big Casa, burned down, and he lost the whole library. That's only part of what this is about. Mariano Vallejo's library. Mariano Vallejo's library was the best in the Eastern Pacific. He was reading Rousseau, Voltaire, some bought from the ship Leonore. The Yankees arrived. He welcomed them, though they drove off his horses and cattle. And then one year the casa, books and all, burned to the ground. The old adobe east of the Petaluma River still stands. Silvery sheds in the pasture once were chicken coops there. The new box mansions march up the slope. At my sister's empty shells book party, some retired chicken growers walked in cuddling favorite birds. Vallejo taught wine growing tricks to Charles Krug and Augustin Harasti. The vineyards now are everywhere. But the anarchist egg growers are gone. The bed of the bay, all shallowed by mining, pre-ice age Sierra dry riverbeds, upturned for gold, and the stream gravel washed off by hoses and swept down to the valley in floods. Farmers lost patience. The miners are gone now, too. New people live in the foothills. Pine pitch and dust, poison oak. The barnyard fence shades jimson weed, datura, toloake, white trumpet flower, dark leaf. The old ones from the world before taught care. Whoever's here, whatever language, race, or century, be aware. That plant can scour your mind. Put all your books behind. We had some young guys in my area recklessly eat a bunch of jimson weed a few years ago. They didn't recover for weeks. I'm not sure if they ever recovered. Waiting for a ride. Standing at the baggage, passing time, in the Austin, Texas airport. My ride hasn't come yet. My former wife is making websites from her home. One son is seldom seen. The other one and his wife have a boy and girl of their own. My present wife and stepdaughter are spending weekdays in town so she can get to high school. My mother, 96, still lives alone, and she's in town too. She always gets her sanity back just barely in time. My former wife has become a unique poet. Most of my work, such as it is done. Full moon was October 2nd this year, so I ate a mooncake, slept out on the deck, the white light beaming through the black boughs of the pine, owl hoots, rattling antlers, castor and pollux rising strong. It's good to know that the pole star shifts, that even our present night sky slips away. Not that I'll see it. Or maybe I will. Much later. Some far time walking the spirit path in the sky. That long walk of spirits where you fall right back into the narrow, painful passageway of the bardo. Squeeze your little skull and there you are again, waiting for your ride. Dr. Coyote, when he had a problem, took a shit. On the grass, he asked his turds where they lay, what to do. They gave him good advice. He'd say, That's just what I thought, too. And do it. And go his way. One thing I worked on in this series of poems was exploring the form called haibun, the Japanese combination of a traditional Japanese poetic combination of a block of narrative prose, a small block of narrative prose, and then a haiku. It's a remarkable form. Of course, the most famous haibun that we know of in the West is Basho's Oku no Hosomichi, the narrow trails of the backcountry. That's only about 35 pages long, which was written as an account. It was the account, you know, ultimately, that he kept of a six-month walking journey from the Tokyo area northward, then crossing west over the mountain ranges to the Japan Sea Coast, walking all the way back down the Japan Sea Coast, and then going back over the mountains again to his little hermitage in on the outskirts of Tokyo, which was called Basho. Basho means a banana plant. And Basho is called Basho because he had a banana plant at his cottage. Almost all of the Chinese and Japanese writers in pre-modern times had little literary names like that. And nobody, you know, refers to them by their family names. I would have to really do a little research to know what Basho's actual family name was. The Zen priests and Zen monks, all the Buddhist priests and monks, whatever school, they all have different names. You know, we have this current tradition in Occidental culture the last few thousand years of getting your name and keeping it your whole life. And there are a lot of cultures where you end up with five or six different names, and you know the name that you were first given nobody would ever use. So, you know, it's just a comment on differences that may or may not matter. I've never considered myself a haiku poet. I don't think that I have written what I would accept as haiku more than three or four times, because haiku has a very specific aesthetic. It isn't a matter of counting syllables. It's a matter of the sensibility and the way things are presented that make a haiku. But I won a prize in Japan for being an international haiku poet. And they dragged me there kicking and screaming all the way. As I said, but I don't write haiku. And, you know, the Japanese are wonderful. They said, well, we know that, but... they said, but the rest of the world doesn't. So they were very nice to me. So these are prose plus a little short poem. This is called One Day in Late Summer. One day in late summer, in the early 90s, I had lunch with my old friend Jack Hogan, ex-Longshore Union worker and activist of San Francisco, at a restaurant in my small Sierra town. The owner had recently bought and torn down the adjoining brick building, which had been, in its time, a secondhand bookstore. Three R's, run by a puckish ex-professor. Our lunch table in the patio was right where his counter had been. I bought many books from him. Jack was married to my sister once. We all hung out in North Beach back in the 50s, but now he lives in Mexico. This present moment that lives on to become long ago. Spilling the Wind. This is out of the Cosumnes River Reserve, south of Sacramento. It's a great place for all kinds of waterfowl. And sandhill cranes come in there, too, although not in such numbers as they do over near Walnut Grove. spilling the wind. The faraway line of the freeway, faint murmur of motors, the slow, steady semis, and darting little cars, two thin steel towers with faint lights high up blinking. And we turn on a raised dirt road between two flooded fallow rice fields. Wind brings more roar of cars. Hundreds of white-fronted geese, from nowhere, spilled the wind from their wings, wobbling and side-slipping down. And actually, you can see that if you pay attention to when they start to descend. These are the larger birds, how they'll turn their wing so that they drop the lift. They break the lift, and they actually begin to fall. And they can come down fast that way. And then they pick up the lift again. And, well, those big tundra swan, they land like a huge jet, sort of coasting in very gradually. My sister, Thea Lowry, who lived in Novato in the Petaluma area, did write a book about the whole Petaluma, California area chicken business. It took her 10 years working on that. It was really a labor of love. And the book was published, and then she was killed by a totally surprise automobile accident, driving down the 101 to a meeting of the grand jury, which she was on, Marin County Grand Jury. She was such a nervy person all her life, with horses, with airplanes, with men, with women, with everything. And the car ahead of her, the pickup truck ahead of her, had a grass-cutting machine that broke loose. Apparently it was tied down, but it broke loose, and the gate wasn't up, and the grass mower, one of those rotary mowers, fell into the lane, and she pulled right onto the shoulder, got out, headed to get that grass mower out of the lane, and was just hit by a car and killed instantly. That was in 2002. For Anthea Corinne Snyder Lowry. She was on the Marin County Grand Jury heading to a meeting south of Petaluma on the 101. The pickup ahead of her lost a grass mower off the back. She pulled onto the shoulder and walked right out into the lane to take it off. That had always been her way. Struck by a speedy car and instant death. White egrets standing there, always standing there, there at the crossing on the Petaluma River. Having been a professor for many years, I'm accustomed to watching the time. It's not bad. Giovanni Singleton said to me earlier, "Well, you're used to breaking conventions." And I said, "Only when I need to," which sometimes is rather frequent. I'm going to read now several very recent poems. Siberian Outpost. This is an esoteric location that only backpackers would ever know about. Going south of Mount Whitney as the Sierra High Country gradually, really, rather swiftly begins to descend, but you're still at 10 or 11,000 feet, the Pacific Crest Trail winds across a virtual desert at the 10,000-foot level to an area that is known on the maps and to backpackers as Siberian Outpost. In a huge foxtail pine open foxtail pine forest that sweeps all along the edge of that. It was known to the early sheep herders and, of course, the packers that are still working in there with their stock, the mule and horse packers. They all know about the Siberian outpost. Oh, here's a little poem I wrote there with, in the presence of Tom Killian. Is Tom here? You're here? Okay. I wasn't sure you were going to make it, Tom. Siberian outpost. What are these deserts? Sheep overgrazed them years ago? A sweeping gallery forest and a gentle 5-mile ridge of foxtail pine. Tom and I walk up the arid slope. Caught in lightning crashes, Siberian outpost meadow, bunch grass tufts and gopher holes, shelter in the space beneath a huge old edge zone foxtail pine. Hailstorm, heavy showers, big root trees, red bark chunks, we stay barely dry. Lifetimes ago, this same tree sheltered me on Thornapple Island. I was a junior bodhisattva then, named No More Tricks. And I was sent to sit with the boulders here an eon or two, till the soil rose up to my eyes. I shook and yanked and stood and said, "Okay, Tom, let's head back to camp. The desert smells like rain." Stories in the Night. Two more poems. Stories in the Night. California, Native California, only had storytelling in the wintertime. They didn't tell stories in the summer. But they had a very, very rich body of oral literature to entertain themselves and to entertain and raise the young people with. And so you're not supposed to read coyote tales or anything like that at all in the summer, only in the winter. Stories in the Night. Yesterday I was working most of the day with a breakdown in the system. Main generator, backup generator, and old phased-out generator number 3. The battery array, the big trace inverter, they had all stopped. Cold, early morning in the dark. Solar panels always work, but there's no sun. Back to the old days, kerosene lamps and wood stoves, always there. The big green Onan, fueled by propane, wouldn't start. One time, turned out, there was a clogged air cleaner. Oil drops blow back up from deep inside. Try to remember, machinery can always be fixed. But be ready to give up the plans that were made for the day. Go back to the manual. Call up friends who know more. Make some tea. Relax with your tools and your problems. Start enjoying the day. First 15 years we lived here, it was kerosene lamps. Heavy tile roof in the shade of a huge pre-contact oak. Sherry, Siegfried's longtime woman friend and partner, is due at any time with a 9-ton truck of 3/4-inch crushed rock. Wet dirt every winter eats up gravel. Keeping a few hard roads for drenching winter rains and melting snows is hard. You have to ditch them, too. In 1962, going all through Kyushu with Joanne, we walked through Hiroshima. Busy streets, coffee shops, green leafy trees, gardens, a lively place. But at Mount Aso, the caldera in the center of the island, the crater 30 miles across, saw sightseers from Nagasaki with that twisted, shiny, scarred, burned face of survivors. And then read Barefoot Gin, 2 volumes in English, the book-length graphic tale of Hiroshima. What got me about the bomb was too much power. And then temptation comes to be the first, to be the superpower of the world. We must change our course around, or there we head. I could never be a Muslim, a Christian, or a Jew, because the Ten Commandments fall short of moral rigor. The Bible's "shalt not kill" leaves out the other realms of life. How could that be? What sort of world did they think this was? With no account for all the wriggling feelers and the little fins, the spines, the slimy necks, eyes shining in the night, paw prints in the snow. Sure, we have to eat, but still, at least say thanks. And that other thing, can't have no other God before me. Like, profound anxiety of power and jealousy and envy. What sort of God is that? Worrying all the time. Plenty of little gods are waiting to begin their practice and learn just who they are. In North India, 4th century AD, some Buddhist teacher lady said, "That God called Yahweh to the West, he's really something. But too bad. He has this nutty thing that he's the creator of the world." A delusion that could really set you back. But returning to energy, I'll fix the Onan. I'll give up on number 3. It's too far gone. And next time I'll get a backup generator with a cast iron block and water cooling and a warranty good for centuries. Put in a bunch of more solar panels for the sun. The old time people here in warm earth lodges 30 feet across burned pitchy pinewood slivers for their candles. Snow after snow for all the centuries before. Lodge fire light and pitchy slivers burning. Don't need much light for stories in the night. So I expect to get a fatwa on me now from somebody. Maybe I'll be defrocked. Final little poem, a letter to M.A., who lives far away, 13-year-old young lady who, I knew her father, and she wrote me about writing poetry, and the whole letter rhymed. So I wrote her back in the same vein. A letter to M.A., who lives far away. "Dear Melissa, I do remember you. You had curly hair and stood by the stair up there on Quadra Isle with a shy smile. Say hello to your mother, Jean. I don't remember your sister's name, and that's a shame, but I sort of remember her face and natural grace. Not all poetry has to rhyme. But this time, I'm writing back the way you did it. It's to your credit. You got me to write this form. Since real poetry is born from a formless place, which is our original face, Zen Buddhists say, in play. So, if this helps you to be a writer, it will please your new friend, Gary Snyder." Thank you. Thank you. So people that need to go should go, and if we'll give them a few minutes to make their way to the exit. Well, does anybody have any questions they'd like to raise or thoughts? Please feel free. Yes.
First of all, fantastic and inspirational reading, and thank you very, very much indeed. Could I just ask you, I'm sorry, it might be a little bit of a technical question.
Of course.
Perhaps almost going back to one of the lines in the last poem about the formless, the place where poetry comes from, the formless place.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's a question in some ways about versification, about how your line moves or works. Do you, as, and I'm aware even in the formulation of the question, it might be a rather silly question, but in composing, are you working from the line to a larger division, like a quatrain or something like that, or how does the line turn for you? How do you get the feeling, given that you're not composing to a strict meter or something mm-hmm. like that? How do you get that sense of when it turns, that mm-hmm. very essence?
This is a question, you know, that addresses really the whole nature of what we call open form poetry or free verse, our dominant poetic form since World War I, or even a little earlier maybe. So it's almost 100 years now that English language poetry has been pretty much in the open form. And the question comes up fairly regularly, well, how do you know what you're doing? If you don't have a form to follow. There are several ways of thinking about that. First of all, nothing is ever formless. And the language itself, in this case the American version of the English language, has its own internal rules and practices. And every language has its own poetics based on the intrinsic, inherent qualities of the language. So the prosody of the English language is based on the play between stressed and unstressed syllables. And that is not a luxury to the language. The placement of stress is essential to comprehension. There are many languages like Japanese in which there is no essential stress. You can understand Japanese talking in an absolute flat monotone, but it does have pitch and tone based on simply individual expression. But English goes beyond that and actually cannot be comprehended without the proper placement of the stress. So then the English language foot, the famous, you know, da-da or da-da or da-da-da or da-da-da and so forth. You know, you can hear them in the language and you can hear them in poetry. Robert Duncan said famously and usefully, if it doesn't have music and if it doesn't have magic, it's not a poem. It has to have both. So the question is, how do you find music in open form poetry? And I still wonder how I do it myself. It's intuitive. It's like, you know, tasting food when you're cooking and knowing when you've done it right. And you listen to the line. You do think of the line as an oral utterance, breath. And it's common to speak of short breath lines and long breath lines. And the emotional impact of a short line or a long line actually is different. And then how you read it, how you perform it, brings additional qualities to it. And I still can't exactly say how I do it, except intuitively by ear. And I also can pick up and read somebody else's poems and know right away whether they have an ear or not. And there are people who write what looks... So poetry is not just where the lines don't come to the end of the page, the edge of the page. There has to be a music in it, but it's... I don't know yet how to explain or describe exactly how to know it, except to taste it, like physically taste it, or to read it aloud. And so that's what I did when I was teaching poetry workshops. I would have students read their poems and other poems aloud, and I'd say, listen to it now. What's going on in it? Half the time, you know, younger students beginning with their poetry can't even read their own poem the way it means what it says. I say, you've got to understand your own poem first. That may be of some help, I don't know. Yeah. Yes.
So does rhyme ever become a distraction then? Is that something sometimes that you have to fight against?
Well, not in English.
If it's a darn good rhyme, does it get in the way?
How many vowels would you say there are in spoken English?
Not too many. Six or eight?
You don't know?
No.
Well, there are five letters of the alphabet that are used for vowels. But I'm talking about the spoken language. How many vowels are there in speech? Well, there's about 10 or 11, depending on whether you call some things a like I and A might be two vowels and one vowel. So English has enough vowels that it's not likely that playing around with rhyme. And what we do in open form poetry or free verse is, you know, we play with internal rhymes, placing rhymes in different ways in different places, and also, of course, assonance, fooling around with consonants. I mean, you can do that all the time, and you can add it on or take it out, and you have to listen to it. There are languages such as Japanese. Which only does have actually five vowels, they don't rhyme because it would be too easy. I'm sure that's one of the reasons they don't rhyme. And Hawaiian has even fewer vowels. I think it only has four vowels, Native Hawaiian language. So when you have fewer vowels, people are more careful about what they might want to do with something like a rhyme. And as I said earlier, every language has its own ways of coming up with a prosody, which... they're very hard to understand if you're not a native speaker of that language. Chinese is a tone language. There are six or seven different languages, actually, that are called Chinese. And the presently standard northern Chinese, Guoyu, what people used to call Mandarin, has four tones. But some of the southern languages, like Cantonese or Guangzhou, they have seven tones. And so that is incorporated into the poetics also, you know. Oh, my gosh, that was hard to learn. You had a question.
Yes. So often in this book, there would be a postcard that you wrote to Alan, and also so often in your life you have reflected to me, come sit, come on out and sit, as you invited Alan and Ed to join you in Japan. And So a question that's coming up for me about this great gift that I feel you've brought to me and many of us, of encouragement to sit and or find your muse in a practice that you such as what you have. What happens or has happened for you between the life of sitting and perhaps not even writing, and then the question of when to write?
That's a nice, complicated question. This person was referring to a book that just came out recently. It's The Selected Poems of Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, published by Counterpoint Press, covering 55 years, I think, about of correspondence. Quite a long time, anyway, from the time that I first moved to Japan. Of course, when I was still living in this country, and Alan and I saw each other all the time, he was living on Milvia Street, we didn't write any letters because we saw each other. So you have to be apart to write letters. That's one of the conditions of that correspondence. Alan was expressing some interest in some kind of practice, even in those days. And also he had entered the graduate school in the English department here, intending to go to work on prosody. He wanted to write something, so research something on prosody, get a PhD and become an English professor. In those days, there were jobs for English professors. But he got started somehow, because of the unruly life of many of his friends and a few suicides, got him working on the poem that became ultimately Howl. Although at first, this is the truth, he called it Strophes. Huh. Yeah. And then he dropped out of the graduate school here. Now, I didn't drop out. I finished that fall with what I was doing in East Asian languages, which was studying literary Chinese and colloquial Japanese. And then I left in the spring for Japan. Now, I had already arranged that. I used the word practice. Sitting meditation is one of the key practices in the Buddhist tradition, and in much but not all of Hinduism. But it is only one of the several practices, and it's a really good place to start, but it isn't the end all of what one can do in the way of studying your own mind, becoming aware of your own consciousness, grasping some sense of what the content of mind is, overcoming boredom or not overcoming it. Chogyam Trungpa was very funny, the Tibetan teacher. He said, "Well, the thing about meditation is it's so boring." He said, "Now that's what you really learn. You learn to be bored." I took off with that with a big riff one year. I said, "Ah, if we can just get enough people to meditate, then we can take over the whole democracy." Why? Because you get power, you get political power in this society, particularly in local politics, by attending meetings. Why don't more people go to meetings? Because it's really so potent. They don't go to meetings because they're boring. But if people sit enough, then going to a meeting will be fascinating. And we could just, you know, keep recycling people back and forth between the meditation hall and the Board of Supervisors hearing or the Forest Service hearing on some timber plan. That worked a little bit in Nevada County. We were working on that. But, you know, so seriously, you know, take into account your own boringness. And then another thing is, you know, the other kinds of meditation, and this is in the early Buddhist literature from the beginning, sitting, standing, walking. And walking meditation is well established in the tradition as another kind of meditation, which in the Theravada countries, they walk very, very slowly. But in the northern Buddhist countries, Tibet, China, Japan, India, Korea, not India, Korea, they'll also walk right briskly, you know, over mountain and dale and go 1,000 miles, you know, or more. But then people used to do that in Europe and the United States too. You know, walking 1,000 miles was not considered a big deal. And I hope the time comes back when we can do that again. Anyway, sitting is really about breathing. And if you can straighten your back and breathe and watch your breath, you can even do it in a chair. Yeah.
So that concludes this week's edition of Dromo Text. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word. You've been listening to Gary Snyder, now 91 years old. He's a poet, essayist, lecturer, environmental activist, anarcho-primitivist, and he's won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry and the American Book Award. He's, of course, associated with the Beat Generation and the San Francisco Renaissance. Well, that concludes this show, this week's show. We'll be back next week with more of the same.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
It takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
For a Free Palestine, an evening of films by Palestinian women, on Monday, July 26th. This is a sunset screening, Cinema Politica's first live event since the pre-COVID era. This event will start at 7 p.m. It will take place behind 3729 Jomos in the alley. Enter by the parking lot on Saint-Famille, just south of Pine Avenue. That's Monday, July 26th. This event is co-presented by the Dakira Collective, Milton Park Citizens Committee, Projection Insurgée, Academics for Palestine at Concordia University, and Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill. Info, cinemapolitica.org. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.